My daughter's like.
She just walked in.
She's like.
Was she following you?
The Joint Committee on Tax Reform for May 4th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, this morning, we're going to hear about the budget, about the needs of the state, and a proposal having to do with the tax plan that the joint work group has been considering. And I'm going to be part of that presentation along with the speaker and the House co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee, so I'll ask them to come forward. I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Smith Warner so we can proceed with our presentation.
Feel the transfer of power occurring right here.
Well, at least in September, it doesn't matter.
Throw your head, okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Please gavel him down at least twice. That will give him a headline.
Good morning.
Good morning, ready?
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, colleagues. Good to see you. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the Oregon House. What a great-looking committee. Good to see you this morning. And with me, we have your House Chair of Revenue and our Co-Chair of Ways and Means. We are here today to bring you some budget information. I know you are the folks that talk about revenue, but revenue isn't just about a number or a tax plan. It's we have resources to fund services, and sometimes I think we forget about the spending side of this conversation. And I think Vice Chair of Ways and Means, Representative Smith, is very knowledgeable about that. In fact, you have 30 plus combined years of experience sitting before you to talk about budget and revenue today. And the presentation we want to make, and hopefully we can get through the whole thing before taking questions, is to look at what is our current spending situation here in the state for spending essential, you know, services that go out into local communities? What can we do around cost containment? And when you look at those two things together, what do we need to do more? What do we need to do, especially for education? Because I think we talk to our constituents all the time. They want us to be investing in education. And so we're trying to put all those things together in one proposal that we're calling the Oregon Education Investment Initiative. Our goal today is just to bring you some facts and reality around the budget and a plan to move the state forward. And I think all three of us here, this isn't about political rhetoric. This is just about the facts and a plan. And we hope you have some good questions at the end. So with that, we have about a 10-slide PowerPoint for you. We're going to start off with what I call the reality check about our budget. And I just also want to say there's been a lot of work put into this in the last couple weeks, but these are very high-level rough numbers. It's very difficult to project all of these things. But we're in the ballpark, I believe, in terms of talking about spending and revenue. And if you look at this chart, and the current law spend in the blue bars reflects what we're currently doing now, often referred to as current service level. There were some assumptions built into this, and you see them at the bottom of the notes. It includes the current Oregon Health Plan caseloads. In fact, we've added in an assumed increase in the provider tax for hospitals and insurance plans. That is currently being negotiated, and some of you on this panel are involved in that. But, you know, we hope that will happen. I think we're close, but it assumes that. So keep that in mind. It's current service level and the assumption of maintaining the Oregon Health Plan caseload and additional revenue from provider tax. It also includes the three ballot measures, CTE, outdoor school, and the veterans services measure for the lottery funds. You'll notice that we have a gap. You can see it graphically in the bars, or you can see it in the budget gap chart table in the far right there. It's 15-17. We balance the budget. That's why we have a dollar left over. But as you go forward, we have gaps between what we're currently doing and what voters have said we should do and what our revenue system can provide. And you all know about adequacy and stability of our revenue system. I wanted to point out with the reserves, one of the good budgeting techniques that we have continue to maintain over the last decade is to build our reserves. So I don't want to forget that. We have been setting aside money, 1% of ending fund balance and some others, into the Rainy Day Fund and Education Stability Fund for the purpose of making sure we have reserves in down times. This is not a downtime. This is, we're in an economic, safe economy at the moment. Things are doing well, plugging along. It's not a time to tap reserves, and frankly, can't tap some of these because of the triggers. But I wanted to make sure everyone realizes we are continuing to manage reserves. But we have a budget gap. You go to the next slide. A couple weeks ago, folks on this committee and others have worked on cost containment proposals, saying this isn't sustainable. We need to come up with ways to do business differently. And there is a strong leadership commitment to doing that. We are still pricing those proposals, and we tried to make some pretty good guesses about what we could achieve in some of these things that can be priced, and we've put them in to the rest of this presentation. Because we need to be more sustainable, and we need to do some targeted cuts even this coming biennium. So just to remind you, potential savings can come from cost containment around PERS in future cost sharing with employees. We were talking a lot about health insurance for public employees, both in the PEB and OEB systems. We could merge them. We could put some price controls on non-primary care. There are proposals to do that. There's a proposal to not have to open a new prison before 2025 if we do some public safety savings. And there are administrative things we can do, some of which are built into the co-chair's budget framework around no inflation adjustments on services and supplies, managing our vacancies differently, things we can do. With all of that, I think a reasonable, well, we'll have to push ourselves to get to this, but I think we could do it. You're talking about a goal for the next biennium of $400 million in cost containment and $250 million in targeted cuts for a total of $650 million for 17-18. So keep that number in mind, because what we want to do going forward is add that cost containment savings and targeted cuts onto our current spending level. So we get, okay, so if we have a current spending level of things that people care about and we do more cost containment, we still have a budget gap between that next number and what our revenue is. That's the next slide. So even after cost containment, again, I'm sure that list of things, PERS and PEB and public safety, you all know how hard some of those things are. And we have a gap between what we do and what our anticipated revenue is. And this slide shows the gap from the first slide, starting off in 17-19 of $1 billion shortfall. If we do the 650 in 17-19, we'd still have a gap of 350 in terms of cost containment, and then it plays out in future years. These are estimates. I want to again emphasize these are very high level, but I think these are conservative in the sense that we have a sense of how hard this situation could be, because I think it's important for the next part of this conversation, which is, if we are managing to just do what we are doing, because there are a lot of things that people care about that we do, we still have a gap in terms of the revenue that is provided in the state. And we hear a lot from people wanting new investments, particularly in education. So where do we go from here, given those budget realities? And so I'm going to pass this over to our co-chair of Ways and Means.
I'm Nancy Nathanson, state representative from District 13. So now you've seen what happens when we do everything that we think is reasonable and even a stretch, a push toward cost containment and one-time cuts. So with all of that, over the next three biennia, we still have to find gap funding. So then the choice is, where does the gap funding come for to pay for education, healthcare, human services, public safety, and other essential services? We could continue this path of finding one-time resources, cuts to programs, continuing into the future for at least three biennia. But is that really what we want to do? And what we're presenting to you today is a very clear choice of continuing the path of using a Band-Aid or doing something that will actually move the dial into a brighter future for us. If we use the current budget approach and simply fill the gap, we end up with still an inadequate education system. K-12 remains inadequate, as does higher education. We still have one of the shortest school years in the nation. We still have very overcrowded classrooms. We have schools without counselors and other sorts of activities that parents have been asking to restore. The cost of higher education is getting worse. You've seen large tuition increases proposed. And people are still struggling despite the economic recovery, so we still need to be providing certain kinds of support systems for those who need it the most. And we also have an aging population and a changing population. We also have facing us the uncertainty of federal budget cuts. We expect there will be some. We don't know exactly what or when or how much. But there is uncertainty about the level of federal investment going out to states. So do we keep kicking this can down the road for next year, for the year after that, and in fact for two more biennia after that? We think there is a different way we can approach this. Instead of merely filling, barely sort of, kind of filling the budget gap that we have for the next biennium, instead of that, and we end up with still a very mediocre education system and healthcare system and public safety. Instead of ending up with something mediocre, is there something new we can do and make a significant new investment in education that will actually move the dial? And we believe there's a prudent proposal that we would like you to consider how it would work. We could make an education investment, for example, of roughly $1.4 billion. And this is a good time for me to remind you, these are estimates. They're not numbers we're pulling out of thin air. I've been working closely with Legislative Fiscal Office for weeks, looking at what it would take to move the dial to make important investments in many different program areas. I could show you a list that's a lot longer than this and adds up to a lot more. We have selected what we think are the key critical investments that Oregonians will recognize as important and significant. And as a matter of fact, the business community would agree with much of this when you read the Oregon business plans from the summit, the white papers, the issue briefs, and the opportunity agenda, and even the policy playbook. You can see support for certain kinds of critical investments in helping people get on their feet and in providing the workforce that business is asking for. So the size of the education investment with a new revenue addition of roughly $2 billion for the next biennium, this is what we could do with it. For example, about $1.4 billion additional for education. We could fully fund the ballot measures that the voters have just passed, and we could invest in essential services for roughly $250 million additional on top of what we are doing now. That would include things such as vital public safety and child welfare, justice reinvestment, and a few of the most critical things that we hear about and the business plan refers to also. I also want to emphasize at this point that this plan, the $2 billion in new revenue that would pay for these critical investments, is not about building a bigger bureaucracy in state government. The lion's share of this goes to local communities. It goes out to school districts. It goes out to universities and community colleges. It goes to students. It goes to counties to help with justice reinvestment, for example. The lion's share of this is about sending money back to communities. In the education area of the investment, which we are proposing in the area of $1.4 billion, we could add significant money to the K-12 system that would add 2 weeks to the school year and reduce class sizes in K through 5. The state school fund would then be something between $8.4 and $8.8 billion. Again, this is all subject to much more work and fine-tuning to determine within each of these areas exactly how much, but this is to demonstrate to you the significant investment that we'd be enabled with a revenue source such as this. In strategic initiatives, another $200 million, for example, we could add for things that you've been hearing are necessary and useful. Teacher mentoring, a focus on equity, school nurses available to kids so that they can learn better and stay in the classroom. Support for English learners, improving graduation rates, reducing chronic absenteeism, school nutrition. Again, these are all things that will really move the dial and help prepare the workforce that business is asking for. We can also do some early childhood new investments, up to $150 million, for example, to expand Head Start, Preschool Promise, access to home visiting supports, and strengthening early intervention and early childhood special ed. We could also make a significant investment in higher education. For roughly $250 million, we know that we could help reduce the proposed tuition increases. We could increase the need-based financial assistance and fund Oregon Promise. So that's what a significant revenue resource could do to make an investment in Oregon that we think Oregonians have been asking for and identifying. It's time for Representative Barnhart to explain some about this, the other half of the proposal.
Thank you. Representative Nathan. I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. I want to take us back before we go into the plan and talk a little bit more about the topic, some of the topics that both of my colleagues here have touched on. My involvement in politics started in 1993, what is that, 24 years ago, when my son's fifth grade teacher was laid off in the Eugene School District as a result of the changes in the budget brought about by Measure 5. Significant reductions in the property tax, despite the legislature's very best efforts, it was impossible to restore school funding. In the 1980s, Oregon was in the top third in terms of school funding, and it showed. We had excellent educational outcomes, low dropout rates, small class sizes, and many, many services that the current generation of students have never seen. We've had a structural deficit in Oregon since that time. It is so normal now that we don't even, many of us don't even think about it as a reality. But Oregon has been living on its reputation for great schools, a beautiful, clean environment, low cost of living, and a variety of other things for a long time. And we continue to bring newcomers into the state because of those things. I submit that we're about to run out, if we haven't already run out, of that reputation because the reality of the structural deficits that Oregon faces that we've had now for 24 years simply is unsustainable. It is now time for us to move ahead and restore and fix the structural deficit that we have faced since that time in a way that actually will promote Oregon livability, Oregon jobs, the viability of our budgetary processes, and the other values that I think all of us hope for and enjoy. This particular proposal is based on, but it is not a proposal by the work group that's been meeting for some time now, but it is based on the framework that the work group established for a new kind of business tax in Oregon. Oregon has been using corporate income tax for a long time now, corporate income and corporate excise tax for a long time now. Paul Warner, Chris Allenack, and others will talk more about some of the issues that are involved in the changes in this structure. But let me simply say that the current structure is unsustainable. Not only do we have the structural deficit that I referred to, but we also have the fact that that structural deficit is getting worse over time as the revenue that we generate as a result of the corporate income tax continues to decline over time. We have the worst of both worlds. We have a very volatile tax, which instead of increasing over time, actually decreases over time. So what does this framework do for us? It does a couple of important critical things, which I don't want any of us to forget. First, it establishes a system of taxation that is stable, and that therefore lacks one of the key problems with the corporate income tax, the lack of stability in good and bad economic times. This proposal is a stable, has a stable base and will continue to operate in a stable way. It also will increase with the size of the economy. As the size of the economy increases, the revenues generated by this proposal will also increase. Another key component of a stable, structurally sound tax system. So what is the proposal that we're talking about today? You've already heard the outline of the framework of the proposal Tuesday, when Paul Warner presented it to the committee. And now I'd like to talk about a more specific proposal. I want you to note the top line of this proposal generates a gross amount of about $3 billion in this biennium, a net amount when you subtract out the corporate income tax by eliminating it because it becomes a duplicate tax, and allowing for some reduction of the personal income tax at low and middle income household levels in order to compensate for the fact that some portion of this tax will in fact be passed along to consumers. Some of it will not. Some of it will actually be paid by the federal government through reduced taxes on businesses, because of the way this tax is structured. And also, some of the tax will be paid by companies that sell motor fuels, and therefore we believe that those funds will have to go into the highway fund, and that's also represented here. I want to note that the proposal is based on the idea of a less than 1%, 0.95% tax rate for businesses, for sales, for business entities above $5 million in Oregon in a year. I would note that a similar amount could be produced by a 0.77%, about 0.75% tax rate, if you were to include about 13,000 more businesses and taxed at beginning at $1 million a year, would produce a generally similar amount. We haven't settled on an exact rate or the exact exempt amount. This also includes a $250 filing fee for businesses smaller than the $5 million or the $1 million figure, down to the size of $150,000. When you exclude $150,000 from a business with that much Oregon sales in a year, you exclude the vast majority of Oregon businesses. When you exclude businesses between $1 million and $5 million, you exclude another 13,000 businesses, and above $5 million, there are only 5,000 businesses in Oregon that are likely to actually pay this tax. The plan here is a stable, workable tax structure that can be implemented, that can pay for these budget deficits. I will note, in addition to what Representative Nathanson has already said, that this doesn't get us to the full funding of the K-12 system. It certainly doesn't get us back to the level of tuition at the universities that students had in 1989 before the Measure 5 passed. But it's a significant step in the right direction, and it gets us out of this chronic structural deficit that this legislature has had to face long before the time I got here. I ran for the school board in 1994 in order to help deal with this budget problem. I quickly learned that the school board had no control over its ability to raise money as it had before. It had lost that to Measure 5. In 2000, I ran for the legislature, and I've been here ever since. I naively believed that we were going to be able to deal with that structural deficit in 2001. I'd explain it to them. They'd say, okay, Phil, we'll take care of it. And I would be able to go back to my psychology practice. I am still here. It is way too long. It is time to fix it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just to conclude with the last slide, colleagues, thank you for your patience and indulgence. You know, doing this exercise, again, these are high-level rough numbers, but it's really important to understand where we're going. If you're going to consider a business tax reform proposal or any taxes, this additional revenue, this session, we should know where we're going. The budget says we have challenges. We have people committed to cost containment, none of which is easy. And we all, I think, regardless of where you come from in the state, want to invest in education. All of this, regardless of new revenue, will require significant fiscal discipline. Cost containment of how this money goes out to local communities and how it's, you know, spent at the local communities really should be a topic of conversation here. But to think that our fiscal discipline and cost containment and just tightening our belt is going to solve this problem is not supported by the numbers. And some will say, well, this is a really large gross receipts tax. It's based on current services. It's based on where we want to go as a state. It's a real number. And I think people need to engage with it and say, okay, is this where we want to go? And take it very seriously. I don't think we can grow this economy, continue to maintain the growth in our economy and grow the workforce without these types of investments. A lot of the things that we're talking about in terms of the education sector are things that the Oregon Business Plan talks about, paper after paper after paper. So again, we're trying to connect what we think we should be doing with our revenue system, and it is inadequate, and this is a plan to make the gap make it up. So why the three last points? We want to invest in education. And you'll see 75% of the new revenue from a CAT would go to education. I think we can come up with a way of guaranteeing that going forward. That is a commitment to the voters we need to maintain. I think we can do that. We don't have that proposal here today because we need to figure that out, but I think that's what we need to do. As our chair of revenue has told us, this provides more stability in our revenue stream. We can get out of the boom and bust cycle of how we do budgets here in the state. We are super creative. We are super talented in one-time resources and patching holes and going biennium after biennium. That is no way to do budgeting. We need more stability. And finally, now is the time. Some people have said this is too complex. We have people who don't want to talk about this because of last November's election. Are we going to make another generation of students wait for the adults to figure this out? That would be a real shame. This is a realistic and doable proposal from both the spending and cost containment side and the revenue side. And so as you continue to hear more about the business tax reform framework out of the work group, I hope you consider where you need to go in terms of how we need to spend. So thank you very much, and we would look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith-Warner. Representative Nathanson, can you please explain to the committee and to everybody about the process that we've had in place for many sessions in Ways and Means and the subcommittees about how agencies, when they come forward, they present a certain, I think it's often a 10% cut that they need to show, and kind of walk people through a process that we put state agencies through each session so that they have to come forward with a certain amount of cuts before making requests. Can you kind of explain that to everybody, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's a routine procedure for agencies to be asked to prepare. The executive branch goes through an exercise, and they ask all agencies to prepare budget alternatives. It's to prepare choices. If there's not adequate resources, what would you do if you had to cut 5% or 10%? What would you cut? And generally, those are displayed in such a way that you can discern the priority order. We would cut this first if we had to. If we had to cut deeper, this is how we would cut. It might be additional programs or deeper cuts in a program that was already identified. So agencies already go through this exercise. In addition to that, agencies also prepare POPs, policy option packages. This is what we think we would like to propose, not what we think, this is what we propose spending additional money on if you have the resources to allocate it. And they would propose new staff or a critical project, for example, software, IT, some systems support. We know that we're really way behind in improving the business of government, and that is holding us back from getting more efficient in many cases. So there are proposals for cutting and proposals for if there is enough resource to add something. Here's what we think is critical and what we propose. In addition to that, however, you also have proposals coming from the legislature through bills on either spending or reductions. And I'm not sure how much more detail you would like about the process, but all of those are reviewed by subcommittees, and the subcommittees then basically target their work to what the co-chairs establish. This is the revenue that it appears we're going to have, and divide the revenue into program areas and instruct a subcommittee to start working on within your program area, how do you manage to this level of resources? And generally, we've been cutting and cutting and cutting. What this plan would do is really a very new approach, which is instead of relying only on the executive branch's proposals, which are one agency at a time, this looks at spending in a broader way. It looks at what is sustainable in the areas of cost containment, not just for now, not just for what would you cut for this year or this biennium, but what can we do to contain costs, not just for 2 years, but to bend that cost curve so that over time we are constraining our current service level growth. So that it's not about how do you grow government, it's about how do you provide services at the level that they ought to be provided, but also with some constraints laid on top of that, saying for the best fiscal management that we can propose, we're going to do this now and into the future. So that's the difference between the agency processes for proposing cuts, which are just one biennium at a time, versus this proposal, which is a new way of looking at permanently bending that cost curve, but then allowing for investments that really move the dial. Instead of saying we're doing business as usual, this is not business as usual. We're going to move the dial.
Thank you. Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a question regarding what's at stake if we don't act. Today we heard what we could do, but what's at stake if we don't?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what is at stake is perpetuating mediocrity. We know that if all we do is barely close the funding gap, we will have a deficit in future biennia. Oregonians will not see education improved at a level where they see smaller classroom sizes, a longer school year, access to health care and nutrition for the kids. I don't think you will be seeing us move the dial in a significant way toward reducing absenteeism and improving graduation rates to the degree that we want to. I think all of that is at stake if we don't make an investment. We will continue funding mediocrity.
Let me add to that answer. The reality is that the economy of a state depends, at least in part, on the capacity of the basic services that are enjoyed by the citizens of the state. If we don't pay for a good, actually I should say excellent, public education program for our kids, we should expect that we will continue to have problems with workforce development. Businesses will continue to be complaining that they can't find workers to fill important roles in their businesses. Long-term, business development, job growth will suffer seriously in a state like that, in Oregon. So it's not just mediocrity in terms of the educational process itself, but it becomes mediocrity or worse in terms of the economy itself. I would ask that business people who are watching this presentation today consider that this proposal may in fact have some short-term detriment to them, and because they're going to be paying a tax they don't pay now. But the long term for their businesses will be a vast improvement in the business climate and environment in the state of Oregon that will allow them to progress, to employ more people, to pay higher wages, to take more money home themselves, to provide the kinds of goods and services that Oregonians need and want to be able to provide for our export economy in a way that will actually help grow the state's capacity. If we do these things that we're proposing, we can get there. If we don't do these things, we depend entirely on the importation of people from other states who do have good educations and who can fill the good jobs that are available. We are right now at very nearly full employment, according to the state economist. One of the reasons we're at very nearly full employment is because we've left a whole lot of people behind because the education system does not meet their needs. We need to stop doing that. We need to stop leaving those people behind, and we need to have those people be productive members of our community in a way that allow for that kind of economic growth. If you look only at your balance sheet or your income and expense statement for this year, may not look so good. But if you look out into the future and see what this kind of proposal can do for the economy and for your business, I think you'll have a different opinion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Madam Chair?
I would like to add one additional comment on what's at stake. We all understand the connections between educational success or academic achievement and what happens for the rest of that child's life. It's about the child, and it's about the family around the child. We've heard about perpetuating cycles of poverty. We know the connections between health and nutrition and education and the child welfare system, the criminal justice system, and social supports that are needed to help keep people out of homelessness, which is a growing problem. So when we improve education, when we can shore up those things that help people be self-supporting and sustain their own families, for example, access to affordable child care so someone can get a job and keep a job, when we can fund adequately mental health treatment and addictions treatment, as well as health care, people can return to work or stay in work. People can stay in the community getting additional supports and help instead of cycling back through the criminal justice system and ending up in the state's custody. When we can make adequate investments in the key areas, we're improving the lives of every Oregonian and the people who live and work around us.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Speaker, for all this work. And co-chair of Ways and Means for all your work, and of course, Chair Barnhart. So years ago, when before I start blabbing, the corporate activities tax, don't you mean the business activities tax? Is that correct? This is not just on corporations that's being proposed, is it?
Correct.
So it's not, it's a business activities tax, a BAT, as opposed to a CAT. Am I correct? I don't want people to read this and think that somehow this is just on corporations. It's not.
Right. No, the point of the, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Benz, the point of this tax is that it is a very broad-based and hits and is paid by businesses with sales in Oregon above $5 million, regardless of the way that business is organized. And that's the way you keep the rate down. Otherwise, the rate would have to be much higher.
Right. Thank you. I just wanted that clarification. So years ago, it seemed to me when I first joined this committee 10 years ago, any kind of tax required an appropriate offset, an appropriate justification. And that's what we're hearing from you this morning, and I appreciate all of the thought. And I have not seen the general statement of education being good, we all agree with, and the general statement of need, I agree with. Sadly, the current environment for this has been affected dramatically by last year's election, just, Madam Speaker, as you mentioned. And so for our purposes of trying to figure out what will work, assuming that there was an agreement that appropriate offsets have been developed, is going to be affected by the thought, hard to avoid, that this particular solution has been damaged badly by what happened last fall. And so I haven't reached a point of agreeing with this approach for other reasons, but if I did, I would wonder if we weren't charging up the hill. I would wonder for a couple of other reasons, not just what happened last fall. But, Madam Speaker, as you know, we've been working really hard on a transportation package, really hard. You have, all of us. And that package contains a fairly large ask from the people of Oregon. Now, the give is clear. It's going to be the benefit of the economic value that's going to come from that investment. Very clear give and take. There's also the small matter of the provider tax, which is still under debate. That's a big one. And then this. And when one starts looking at this altogether, you go, wow. And each one of those requires that appropriate offset, and you have made a case today for it. I would suggest the case is still lacking a primary motivating element. The clarity on the cost containment side, for example, that's a really good start. But there's got to be something that overweighs the thought that most of us have about last November. What is it that suddenly has changed? What? Because most people are still going to see this as a sales tax, and they're going to be unhappy with it, and the matter is going to get referred. We have these same conversations all the time. So I'm not going to go into the detail, which is easy to do. I'm much more interested in the ultimate outcome of this exercise. Now, I'm not saying anything that you don't know, but I want to call out the incredible difficulty we now face as a result of what went on last year. And you've already mentioned it briefly, Madam Speaker. I would like you to elaborate on it and explain to us how we don't charge up this hill for nothing.
Madam Chair and Representative Benz, thank you for the question. I always think it's worth it charging up the hill for our kids, so let me just say that, just to put it out there. Last December, after the business summit, Senate President and I sat in a room with business leaders here in the state who said, okay, election is over. We're serious about what it means to put the state on stable footing. We want to work with legislators to come up with a plan. And we heard loud and clear that cost containment had to be part of that. And I think you have some very serious proposals that will require all of us to go up a hill to put some structural stability back in our the spending side of the equation. And the Senate President and I are very committed to that. What I have seen over the last couple of months is kind of the retraction from the business community of, we want to be at the table to show us what you can do first before we can talk about anything. I want to go back to one of my final comments about waiting for an entire another generation of students while we figure out how to do this. This is all about choices, Representative. This is all about whether or not we believe that the number one priority for the legislature is to provide for essential services, from public education to health care to senior services to public safety, and to balance the budget. There are a lot of things going on in this building. The number one priority is to balance this budget in a way that grows our economy and protects the citizens of the state to have what they need to be successful. And in terms of the provider tax, I think the idea that you put out cuts and somehow you're creating fear, the reality is we need revenue to continue the Oregon Health Plan caseload. And hopefully that provider tax gets done. That's why it was built into that very first reality slide. I'm not going to pull any punches. We assume we're going to do that. We need to do that. We still have a problem if we do that. I hear your comment, Representative, but we're adults. We all make choices. My choice is to march up the hill and try to do this.
May I add, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, a couple of more specific comments to this issue. A couple of the points made by the opponents to Measure 97 are well addressed in this proposal. The reality of this proposal is that when it's completed, it will reflect where the money is to be spent. And you've heard a fairly clear outline from the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee about that aspect, and I expect that a final bill would reflect that expenditure promise. Also, of course, what that means is that if for some reason the tax did not go into effect, that would be where the cuts would come in the budget. That's a different from the situation that was in 97, where the argument was made that the legislature could do whatever it wanted to with the funds. In this case, we will have allocated them and made specific budget decisions by the time that possibility could occur. The second point was that some of this actually gets passed along to consumers. I strongly object to the argument that this is simply a sales tax. It is not. It is a very different kind of structure. But it is true that some portion of the tax will be passed along to the ultimate consumer. And that's the reason for the part of the proposal that would allow for an income tax change reduction for those who would be most hard hit by that passing along of costs. That's also very different from the argument that was made against Measure 97.
Do you have a follow-up? I was going to say I have four more people.
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Okay. Yeah. Representative Noos?
I'll pass for a moment.
Okay. Representative Marsh?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, panel, for being here. It seems to me one of the strong arguments for moving forward is really understanding the long-term view of our current budget trajectory. And to that extent, I have just a couple of specific questions about the budget gap analysis that you presented to us. Could you tell us what rate of growth is assumed in there? And then I'm curious, there's a little blip in 21-23. Can you tell us anything about what that consists of?
And Madam Chair and Representative Marsh, thank you for the question. Again, I will start off by saying, and Legislative Fiscal would appreciate that I emphasize this, these are rough numbers in trying to anticipate growth as well as revenue. And it also, the revenue projections also continue to distribute to the reserve funds. So I think that's a really important point. So the 21-23, you know, the change in the budget gap, I kept looking at those numbers last night. I can't figure that out either. It might have something to do with potentially I have to go back to the spreadsheet, might be when some tax credits are up for recycle, you know, so the number might just be off. But you see just, you know, generally a consistent level of gap there. In terms of the growth, I'd have to go back and check. I think it's based on what we've been doing growth-wise in terms of overall caseloads and things like that. So, and we wanted to try to be consistent with what we're doing in terms of current spending. So not to, like, you know, funny the numbers up, say, what are we currently doing? And then, so we're not trying to take some reductions and then cost containment off of that. We took, it might be anywhere from 8 to 11%. I'd have to look. It depends on the area. Mm-hmm. But then we put the cost containment on top of that. So we were, you know, having a good base to start with and then taking off the cost containment percentage. Again, this is, or the hard numbers. So, again, it's a little bit of a, it's a hard thing to estimate. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the approach we took to kind of come up with that graph.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some problems with characterizations. You've made some factual statements. But what assurances, for example, what assurance do we have that these dollars will actually get into the classroom and we won't see the continuing sopping up of these dollars into K through 12 education through step salary increases, very generous health benefits, and taking care of our underfunded pension system? And the other characterization that I have a problem with is that we have a revenue problem when we actually have a $1.5 billion excess over last budget cycle. To me, we have a cost containment problem. And now my question. It seems that your cost savings that you're proposing are quite fuzzy as opposed to the tax increases, which are laser focused once again on this hidden sales. How do you assure us that these cost savings will be perpetuated through time?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, really all very good questions. I'm not sure. I think we have an expectation problem in this state, so maybe I'll just start there. People have expectations about what they want their schools to look like, what kind of services, and I think we have done our best, particularly over the last decade or 15 years, to try to meet those expectations. I mean, I think probably seen people on this panel never liked the budget we passed in 15 on K-12. One of the largest K-12 budgets in the state's history, and people still thought it wasn't enough. So I think we have a bit of an expectation gap. But in terms of hard numbers, even the numbers from Mr. Warner on the revenue are estimates. So yeah, they're a little easier to put into a presentation like this. I don't want to pretend that I can say four down to the last dollar that these numbers, but I think these are pretty much in the benchmark. In terms of the ongoing cost savings, I think we have to figure out how to structure that to make that happen. I mean, some of the budget principles that you have seen come out of the cost containment work group about how we do things, like not using one-time resources for things that roll up, how we manage just structuring the budgets, and that's a better question for the co-chair. Those things might not necessarily result in a lot of actual savings, but they will help us do our business better. The things listed on the cost containment slide, I think, are things you could actually quantify. We can quantify $20 million in savings in the next biennium to keep us from opening a new prison, for example. That came from the Criminal Justice Commission. We have a hard number on that. We have some preliminary estimates on cost controls in PEB and OEB that could save us up to $100 million in the next biennium. We'll need to further refine them. But in the interest of not waiting to have, you know, everything down to the last cent, we're trying to put out a proposal that is generally true to where these numbers are, and we have to continue to refine to make sure we can hold on to those savings going forward. I am very open, if we are committing to this level of revenue, to talk about cost controls at the local level. I think that's our fiscal responsibility to do that, and I am all on board on that. So if people have proposals on that, let's talk about it. It's a lot of money that we say are going to produce the outcomes we want. Let's make sure it happens.
So I want to apologize to my colleagues. We do have one more presentation that we're trying to get in today. So I'm thank you all for your presentation and for answering questions. I know there are a couple of folks who had some questions. I apologize, but I know we want to get to our final presentation for today.
And we're not going anywhere.
Okay. Amen. Thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, colleagues. Really appreciate the time.
Follow you next.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and the members of the committee. Just We had a couple of things that we had prepared based on the discussion from Tuesday, and wanted to just kind of continue discussing some of the implications of the framework, revenue package, or revenue outline. First thing in your OLIS, there's a couple of things we put in response to some questions and comments from Tuesday. One is references to the a tax foundation summary of gross receipts experience in other states. So Nicole Kading put that together a short while ago, or 2 years ago. And so we'll put that out there, and it talks about the experience in Indiana, the New Jersey, and Kentucky experiences with a receipts-based corporate minimum, similar to what we have in Oregon. So that's there for your reading, and any questions you have on that, let me know. The other one we put out is one we came across in the fall that was a good explanation of the Ohio experience. It was an analysis of the Ohio revenue system put together by their comparable to our Oregon CPAs, the Ohio CPAs. I guess they have the same acronym. But they did an analysis of the entire Ohio system, and they have a chapter in there on the commercial activity tax, which I think is good reading in terms of what their perspective is on the Ohio CAT. It's, you know, been in place for 10 years, so it gives you a sense of kind of where they think it is and what their suggestions are for improvements. So that's for your reading. We wanted to do a couple things with you in the remaining time. Is kind of go from a micro look at the framework and its implications, and then have a step back for a kind of a macro state finance look at it, and which really kind of follows up on some of the stuff the speaker had and the co-chair looking at the long run projections. So I'll turn it over to Chris. He's got some examples to go through with you. Keep in mind, these are examples, but we get asked a lot about if you're a business that's organized a certain way, has a certain amount of income and so forth, what are the implications of the change that's proposed in the framework? In other words, eliminating a corporate income tax and going to something based on receipts or a commercial activity tax.
So, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Smith?
Okay, your turn still.
Sorry.
I apologize. I'm new to revenue, and I'm a ways and means guy. So what we just heard, is that the new framework that we're considering as a committee? Is that the topic before us that we're considering, or is that just an idea that was presented to the committee?
Could I respond to that, or Senator?
Either or both co-chairs, whoever would like to take a shot at that.
No, that's not the framework. I think it's a good idea. I think ultimately collaboration and consensus will carry the day, and what the rates are and the base and a myriad of other policies within the larger policy.
And I promise you, I'm not trying to be vindictive or any of that. I'm just trying to get my arms around how this works. And,
yeah, no,
and on Tuesday we heard one concept, and now we've heard another concept, and I'm trying to figure out where we move in with this.
A comment on that point. I don't think there are different concepts. I think this is more specific.
More specific. Okay.
Than the Tuesday. It's based on exactly the same framework,
okay,
as the one that was presented on Tuesday. Tuesday didn't contain any rates or dollar amounts.
Okay.
Today, the proposal contained was a much more specific kind of proposal based on the framework that was presented on Tuesday.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And a further comment, if we're going to do take an action this year, we need to start narrowing choices fairly rapidly. And so one of the ways of accomplishing that is to put a proposal out and ask for responses to it.
Okay.
And that, I think, was the important point of the presentation you just heard.
Okay, I just got confused because on Tuesday we were talking about corporations, and I was asking about community development corporations and cooperatives, and today we're talking about a tax on all businesses.
Ah, if I could, Madam Chair, there may have been a misunderstanding on Tuesday because the proposal that we were working on included all businesses. I think the term corporation sometimes gets used in reference to business rather than a specific legal organizational entity.
I'm a director of a small business development center. We talk sole proprietors, partnerships, right. LLCs, corporation, S-corps, all those.
You understand the details.
I do. Okay, we're good.
Of the processes in ways that most other people don't. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I can
Senator Hass. I guess I got the gavel back. Okay.
The nice thing about this committee and being in the legislature is our access to the Legislative Revenue Office, where we can look at all kinds of different combinations of rates and bases and just keep looking at those scenarios. And then in addition to that, we have a pretty sophisticated computer modeling through OTIM where we can see, okay, here's how much earners under 25,000 would pay, and then we can modify the numbers like that. And that's something that we have at our disposal that the initiative authors do not.
Right.
And so that gives us an advantage to be very precise.
And please, no, I wasn't mean to be antagonistic.
No.
I was just trying to get my arms around the conversation. Yeah, thank you.
But I think it would be very useful to allow Chris the time to present us with some examples of how this would work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And just listening to the conversation here, I'm seeing some changes I should have made in the title here. It says simplified examples of trading a kit for a cat, a CIT for a... And the CIT, that's the corporate income tax. The CAT here is a commercial activities tax. So the change I'm realizing I should have made was spell those out and not use the acronyms. And further here, this is based on a commercial activity tax rate of 0.75%. In order to come up with examples, we need details of a policy. So just the 0.75% here is just chosen to produce some examples here. And some of you may have seen me go through similar examples earlier in the session, but I'm just gonna walk through some examples. This is very much in the weeds and very simplified examples. So the first two here are C corporations. So the first one is a retailer. It's a retailer that has about $315 million of cost of goods sold, and they have sales of $500 million. So their costs are $315 million, their sales are $500 million, and their margin here is 2%. It's an example of a low-margin business. And most of these margins here, they are just examples. They are taken from very broad statistics at the federal level, but they are just examples to illustrate some points. So the taxable income then is the sales times the margin. It's just that simple. And so on $500 of sales at a 2% margin, this C corporation would have taxable income of $10 million. And their income tax would be just under $750,000. That's the current structure of a 6.6 and 7.6% rate, with $1 million being the demarcation. And then the 0.75 CAT is the 0.75% times the $500 million in sales, and that's just over $3.7 million. Now this is $250, and the rate is applied to sales above $1 million. I'm just now realizing I left off that detail too, I apologize. So in going for a policy that would create or eliminate the income tax and establish it for a 0.75 CAT, their tax would go from about $750,000 to $3.7 million, an increase of $3 million. The next example, C Corporation again, it's a manufacturer. This one has about just over $390 million in cost of goods sold, and their sales are $750 million. At a margin of 3%, their taxable income is 19.9, just under $20 million. Their income tax is $1.5 million. And then the commercial activities tax would be $5.6 million. So those are kind of simple C corporation, trading one for the other. Now we get to some of the other business forms. So we have two sole proprietors here. So the first one is a retailer. It's a small retailer. Their cost of goods sold, $500,000. And they bring in $800,000 in sales. Their margin is 9%. That's taxable income of $100,000. Their income tax, now this is the personal income tax, And this is just the standard 5, 7, 9, and 9.9% rate structure, results in a $6,000 income tax. And at a 0.75 cat with a $1 million threshold, the only thing they would pay is the $250. So the min tax there refers to that $250. The next example is we have a sole proprietor who's in construction. They have cost of goods sold just over $2 million and sales of $5 million at a margin of 18%. So now we're getting to businesses that have a slightly higher margin. Their taxable income is $800,000. The personal income tax is $76,000. And then the commercial activity tax would be $30,000. And here there isn't a the difference column is blank right now because we're not trading the, because these are not C corporations. And in part of the information that Paul outlined on Tuesday was this issue of some sort of offset potentially on the personal income tax for this new tax for these non-C corporations. The next example here we have is a partnership. It's a law firm with 10 partners. Their cost of goods sold is $4.1 million. They have sales of $50 million. A margin of 27% means they have taxable income of 13.6%. Now, this is a partnership, so I just assume that that income gets divided uniformly across the 10 partners, so every partner has taxable income of $1.36 million, and they're subject to an income tax. Now, here, this is not what I've done, again, for simplification or quite possibly oversimplification, is they're not subject to the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9%. They're subject to the pass-through rates from the 2013 special session. And that starts at 7.2%, 7.2, 7.6, and so forth. And so their income tax collectively is just over $1 million on those pass-through rates. And then their commercial activities tax would be about $368,000. The S corporation is a similar kind of structure as the partnership. It's subject to the pass-through entity rates. This one is a consulting firm, 10 shareholders, cost of goods sold $30 million, sales of $75 million, and at a profit margin of 13%, that results in $9.8 million of taxable income. The income tax here of $718,000 is again a result of the 7.2 and 7.6 rate structure. And then the commercial activity tax of 0.75% would be $555,000. So those are the straightforward, simple examples. The last one I wanted to touch on gets into some of the nuances of the corporate income tax structure. And what we have here is a software designer, and I put two versions up here because we're talking about an intangible. It's a service company, so they're subject to the cost of performance. So the apportionment here, without going into all of that detail again, is a bit different, and it's not intuitive the way that kind of a market distribution is. So the first one here is the software. We're talking about a software designer who has cost of goods sold of just under $34 million and sales of $245 million. And in this first one, all of their costs are in Oregon. They are located here, and they sell to Oregon and Idaho. So of those $245 million in sales, $100 million is sold in Oregon, and $145 million is sold in Idaho. So their taxable income is $12.1 million. It's the 5% times the 245, and all of that shows up here because all of their costs are in Oregon. All of their 100% of the cost of performance is in Oregon, so all of their sales, even the ones that actually occur in Idaho, are attributable to Oregon. And their income tax is just over $900,000. And the commercial activity tax would be $743 million. So they would actually experience a slight tax cut in trading out the corporate income tax for the commercial activities tax. And then the very last one here, it's the same setup, same company, except all of their production is now in Idaho instead of Oregon. They still have $100 million sales in Oregon and $145 in Idaho, but their taxable income in Oregon is zero because of this cost of performance. All of their taxable income gets attributed to Idaho, so Oregon doesn't get to tax any of that. So their income tax is zero, and the commercial activities tax would be the $743. So for this case, depending on where their production is, it could be a $700,000 tax increase. So I realized that was kind of quick.
Great. Senator Riley?
Thank you. Chris, could you tell us a little bit about federal deductibility of Oregon taxes?
Chair Barnhart, Senator.
As it relates to this issue, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, all of the taxes paid here are deductible at the federal level. They're all cost of doing business. All of the business taxes are deductible at the federal level. So the difference here doesn't account for the difference that I have in here is just the simple difference between these two taxes. It doesn't incorporate the impact of deductibility.
Right.
If I were to include that piece, the difference would be a little bit about on the order of maybe 25% less, because the federal taxes would be reduced by about that percentage.
So the current taxes follow.
Please, yeah.
So the current way we tax is not federally deductible.
No, it is.
It is. Okay, so, but the difference would be about 25%, you said?
Right, in that top example, the first corporation where their taxes here go up by $3 million, that would be deductible. I'm not including the federal deductibility.
I understand, okay, thank you.
Right, now that doesn't apply, does it, to the personal income tax calculations that you made in other parts of your examples?
They would be deducted as well. They're deducted. They're a cost of doing business. So the businesses are deducting when they fill out their federal tax forms. They would be able
they're
to deduct those as well.
The cap portion,
correct,
of the tax. Thank you, Senator Bushrick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things, Chris. On the federal tax deduction, I think we should be made clear if the taxes you pay, like in 15, you don't get to deduct it until the next year on the federal forms.
Correct. When you file your tax return. Yes.
So there's a year lag there. But my question is on the sole proprietor partnership and S corps. You're with this scheme, we are exposed to personal income tax as well as the CAT tax. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair.
Yep. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you mind working with our office, not today, but work with our office? I'm curious how this would affect farmers who are in very, very tight margins and, say, have 1-2%. Would you get? Could we visit with you on that?
Yeah,
because obviously Eastern Oregon's going to want to know. We've got a lot of farmers out there.
And it'll depend. Some large. It depends on if they're structured as C corps and or.
I'm primarily thinking LLCs.
LLCs.
Let's
yeah.
Let's visit.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hass, please.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up on Senator Bertschiger's question. I think your comment was, so there'd be these two taxes, and in our work group discussions, there was consensus around dealing with that, just like Ohio did, differently maybe than Ohio did, but as a practical matter, we would fix that through a credit.
Yeah. Right. And that was part of the work group conversation, wasn't it? Yeah.
Same thing.
Representative Vance.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm building on that same question. Sub-S paid the gross receipts tax,
it's just a credit.
Is that then viewed as a subtraction, a deduction, or something from that, which is then income to the shareholders?
Correct.
They don't have to pay tax on the same taxed amount twice.
No, that new tax, the commercial activities would be a business deduction, a deduction of business. So the full amount would be deducted from their gross income, and it would reduce their federal taxable income.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? I thank you very much. Anything else? I should note that it is the current plan that we'll meet at 8:30 on Tuesday. Agenda's not ready yet, but it will be soon. Anything else? Thank you all so much. And with that, committee's adjourned.
This is interesting.
With that, committee's adjourned.
This is interesting.